and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, thus becoming yourself part of a decentralized, democratic civic media. Thanks very much for listening.
When news is profit-driven, are you getting the whole story?
What kind of news show would you create?
Come to KPFT Monday night at 7 p.m. to add your voice to the Indie Media News Show Collective.
Well, you'll have the chance to cover the news that matters to you and your community.
No experience required. That's Mondays at 7 p.m. at 419 Lovett or visit houston.indymedia.org.
This is KPFT Houston.
This is Linnell Anderson, chair of the Texas Bucket Brigade, a nonprofit volunteer environmental organization working with the citizens of Houston neighborhoods, training them to take samples of the air we breathe. The samples are analyzed so we know exactly what chemicals are in the air. If you're interested in learning more about environmental issues in Houston, sampling the air in your community, or if you are interested in health impacts of exposure to toxic chemicals, we want to hear from you. You're invited to participate in a survey that we're conducting. We want to know how Houston air pollution is affecting you and your family. Give us a call today at 281-360-3333 or contact us at survey@texasbucketbrigade.org. We need your input. This is listener-sponsored Radio Pacifica, KPFT Houston.
You listen to KPFT, you enjoy some of our fine programming, and you have done your part to keep us commercial-free by calling in a pledge of support. Hats off to you for taking that first step. But before you settle into that fantastic feeling, don't forget, you still need to send in that pledge of support to finalize your promise to KPFT. But be warned, that fantastic feeling will soon follow. Thanks for supporting KPFT Houston.
This is Mary Jane, and Houston's Best Summer Music Festival is coming Saturday, July 31st, and Sunday, August 1st. It's the Watermelon Dance and Summer Social at the Last Concert Cafe, 1403 Nance Street. On Saturday, hear bands like Us and Them, The Hightailers, Pot Roast, Mikado, Little Brother Project, and more.
And some of the bands Sunday are Drop Trio, Myrna Sanders, Mark Zeus, Carolyn Wonderland, and New Monsoon. The hours Saturday are 5 till you drop, and Sunday 3 to close. The gate benefits KPFT 90.1 in Houston.
It's about the music. It's about the fun.
It's the organic melons.
Project Grad Houston is a nonprofit with a 10-year track record for improving academic performance and increasing high school graduation and college attendance rates among Houston's inner-city students. Project Grad Houston works in partnership with HISD, the community, families, teachers, and students. By 2005, one-third of HISD students will be a part of Project Grad. Project Grad students currently attend universities including Cornell, Princeton, Rice, University of Virginia, Texas A&M, and the University of Houston, and the University of Texas. KPFT 90.1 knows graduation really achieves dreams, and we urge you to get involved by volunteering or supporting Project Grad today. For more information on Project Grad Houston or to make a contribution, please visit www.projectgradhouston.org.
And you usually do that before the mic is on. You're listening to KPFT, and this is the New Capital Extended.
This is Monday Night Radio.
This is Monday Night Radio.
Yeah, New Capital just ended.
Right, New Capital just ended with that incredible interview that Dave Adelson did with Ray McGovern. In fact, you know, we should probably get Dave on. We're trying to get hold of Ray McGovern, but apparently he's not home yet. But on the line with us at the present moment is the grandmother of us all, Lynn Gary. I'm sorry, that's not an age comment.
Okay, hi.
How are you? Are you familiar with this interview?
Yes, I am.
Okay, and, you know, I really want to get him because the question I want to ask him is, gosh, does anything you said in here have anything to do with the news that we've heard the past couple of days that the CIA has blindsided poor George Bush?
Yeah, actually, I have some questions for him that go even, that are, I guess, even more basic than that, because when I heard this interview, I found it to be one of the most fascinating and also one of the most disturbing interviews that I'd ever heard. And perhaps not for the reasons that Ray McGovern would think, because his concerns about the fate of the country is not a revelation to me. But he himself, and the way that he spoke about the CIA, given the history of the CIA and its role in American foreign policy and the idealization of the CIA's noble mission, I guess that is how I would characterize it, you know, on the one hand, and then as he goes on to describe how the invasion of Grenada had nothing to do with intelligence, but it was a way to recoup the image of the Reagan administration as a result of the Marines killed earlier in Beirut, so they would invade a country, kill a bunch of people to do that. And this being a rather routine occurrence, something in which the CIA participates and has participated in many times. You know, from the, you know, the Contra War in Nicaragua, the invasion of Panama, Grenada, the first Gulf War, you know, under Poppy Bush, when Saddam Hussein was willing to pull out of Kuwait, and the Russians, in fact, had been working to negotiate a peaceful settlement. And but no, that was not acceptable. War was what was wanted, and war was what we had.
Well,
I guess I see this as a whole, a continuity, not so much as a radical departure as has been portrayed in the interview.
Well, I was going to say, I listened to it about a week ago, and my impression of what he was saying was that, he wasn't advocating that. He was simply saying this is one of those typical situations where the leader wants to do something to, you know, reinvigorate his fading image, and that that he was objecting to the use of the CIA, making the CIA complicit in that. That was how I heard it. I mean,
well, I think that he was, except that I would say that the question is, how complicit has the CIA actually been in all of these misadventures, and to what extent have these things been initiated from the CIA?
But did you hear the wonderful, in fact, Dave Adelson, who actually interviewed Ray McGovern, is on the line with us. Hi, Dave.
Yay.
Hey, you guys. How you doing?
Hey, David.
And hey, everybody who's listening.
That wonderful interview with about the Mossadegh overthrow.
Mm-hmm.
Which actually in 1953, that was the event that really radicalized me. I mean, that was, you know, I was 13, and it's like, wow, you know, this is an amazing thing that nice Eisenhower's going to destroy this whole country.
Well, one of the things that Ray emphasized was the division within the CIA between,
right,
quote, operations and analysis, and suggesting that they were really two entirely separate cultures that were grafted together, and that grafting was actually a key failing. But even if you allow that, I think, you know, Lynn is making a point about what is the overall role of that agency within the political environment or political goals of the United States. And that's why I hope we really can get Ray on, because he's a fascinating
great
gentleman,
question.
And it would be very interesting to talk to him about his conception of the role of the analysis function. And one of the things I tried to get at in the interview, and actually had to cut out a chunk of it to make it fit radio, but was this question of, you know, what your politics, how your politics affect the function of analysis, and in
particular, well, you asked that. That was in there.
Attention to
that was in
there.
Yeah,
but there was. We actually spent a lot more time on it than actually ended up in the interview. But anyhow, I do hope we get a chance to ask that question, because I know that in the movie Uncovered, I had the experience of feeling like a lot of people were shocked to find gambling going on in this establishment, and particularly when Milt Bearden talks about preemptive war being this new thing in Western history, that not since the Treaty of Westphalia has anybody presumed to engage in preemptive war. And Ray's own citation of Hitler's wars, of Hitler excelling in preemptive war, that notion that that's not something we've ever done is an odd notion to me. Just because we've never used that particular excuse doesn't mean we've never gone to war to pursue interests.
Well, Aline just went through a list of wars, you know, Panama, Grenada, etc., that were all preemptive wars. I mean, there was no justification for what we did.
Well,
nobody had done anything to us.
They're not preemptive. In other words, we're engaging in this kind of war in order to stop an attack on the United States. There were other reasons given, and so I think that's the distinction they're drawing. And what is worth understanding is, why is that distinction important? What does it include, and what does it leave out?
I think Philip Agee probably called McGovern and said, don't go on.
Well, he did say he was exhausted, having been up all night writing an article that appeared on TomPaine.com. So if any of the listeners would like to read more of what Mr. McGovern has to say, they can go to TomPaine.com.
Yeah, and he may show up later, and certainly we will be taking your calls.
Lynn,
I felt like Lynn... Okay, Scooter then, Lynn.
What?
No,
Lynn,
I felt like Scooter. I cut Lynn off when I said something. What? No? Oh, Lynn.
No, yes, actually, the point that... the question that David raised about the connection between, or the disconnection between, the analysis and the operational arm, and this is the primary question that I want to ask Ray. And since it doesn't look like we're going to have him, I guess I'll just bring it out to the group mind here.
Well, if we get him, we'll get it.
Okay. Well, in the interview, it begins where Ray explains what his role in the CIA was, and how he was at obviously the highest level, tasked with giving briefings to the president, vice president, and other senior officials, creating these national intelligence estimates, which were to be the final word on the global situation from the standpoint of the CIA. So in order to be in this position, a person has to be, in the eyes of the agency, someone who clearly understands what the mission is. In order to advise somebody on something, you have to have a concept of what is success, how one defines success. And the question I wanted to ask Ray is, when you or someone else, a senior official in the CIA, goes in to advise government officials, both on their plans and on bringing things to their attention that ought to be brought to their attention, what is your criteria for what is a priority, for what is success, and for what is important?
Well, if I could, I'll play what I would think Ray might answer that, because I asked him questions like that. If they ask a question, if the policymakers ask a question, what do you think is going to happen if blah, 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 if we do this, or what is the interest of this person, or something like that, I think Ray would argue that he is able to, would be able, based on his understanding of the situation, to give an answer to that without himself having to do a calculation about, oh, what does this person need to know or not know? Does that make any sense, or do you consider that
no,
unreasonable?
Because I'm going somewhat deeper, and he said, in fact, in the I have the advantage, unlike the audience, of having heard the unexpurgated version of this interview, which is quite a bit longer, and he says that not only does he answer questions, hypotheticals, such as Dave just posed, but he also says we bring to their attention things that ought to be on their plate, things that, you know, bringing something to their attention that is a matter of concern. Okay, so I guess my question is, Well,
how would they determine
the CIA,
what would be the
what
criteria?
Is the matter of concern? Here's the thing: we have Democrats, Republicans, the inhabitants of the Oval Office and these other high offices change. The foreign policy never changes. The foreign policy is a consistent pattern through various administrations of regime change, support of foreign governments that basically put their countries' resources and people at the exposure of the profit-making activities of U.S. economic elites. I mean, now I'm giving away. I mean, I'm giving away my perspective on this.
Well, I don't think you'd have to keep it secret.
No, but what I'm saying is, I mean, I would if I was talking to Ray, I would just like to hear how he responds to that, because my question is the CIA, which is a permanent body of people that last throughout these administrations, so to speak, that have their own, it has its own regeneration process, how much are these people in the CIA setting the policy, irrespective of whoever is in office?
Great question.
How much are they setting the policy?
Yeah.
And how much are they making sure that certain things happen, irrespective of whatever goes on in the public political arena? And the Iran-Contra affair was a great example. Congress had even passed the law. The Boland Amendment, that arms were not to be given to the Contras. Well, meanwhile, the administration and the CIA were busy, smuggling guns, smuggling drugs, assassinating civilians, bombing villages. But then a few years later, they go down and invade Panama on the pretext that Manuel Noriega is a drug dealer.
Right. Well, okay.
And what gives them the right to go kidnap the head of state?
Wait, but that's good.
Difference between operations and analysis.
I think I know what Lynn is saying, because she's saying what the question is. What he's saying is we have to advise the president, and the question is what are the criteria of what we consider to be important? Am I right?
That's right. Because the analysts.
Okay. Wait. Don't go on.
Then they send the covert operations arms
separate.
They make.
No, but he made a very big point that was a separate thing, and he spoke about the one of the things he said in the beginning was this thing about the pride that the analysts have in the accuracy of their work, and that's why they got so upset when they're told to fudge it. But Dave, what do you got?
Well, I guess one of the things I wanted to deal with relates to a book that Lynn on her radio show read in its entirety over the period, I think, October through April, and that's a book called Disciplined Minds, and it was about the professions and the professionalization process, what it means to be a professional. And in that book, it talks about one of the key aspects of being a professional is a kind of acceptance of the institutions within which you operate as a professional. And what's important about that is, if you've accepted the virtue of those institutions and then within that context are trying to do your best to behave professionally and effectively, honestly, with integrity and ethically, and I think based on what I know of him in my discussions, I would say those are all traits that McGovern aspires to and probably is an example of in many ways. But the definition of what it means to be ethical, have integrity, be professional within those institutions is this kind of meta question.
Yeah.
And the people who challenge that meta question, who consider the possibility that the whole institution itself from its roots is messed up, then those people don't make it through that process. They don't achieve the rank. And so if you have achieved the rank within that system and you recognize that something's deeply wrong, some contradiction presents itself that lets you see that what you thought were your professional ethics are being violated, and you say something is terribly amiss here, and you find somebody like Alin, for example, saying, no, it's not that anything's terribly amiss here, it's that you misinterpreted the role of the institution. The institution has different aims than the virtuous aims that you took for granted, or not for granted, but thought about when you went into this. And I have this funny feeling that that's where the contradiction lies. And that may be some of the area in which Lynn is disturbed. And it's just a tragedy that we couldn't be having this conversation with Ray. But yeah, perhaps we should hear from some listeners about what they
asleep.
Think about it.
Yeah. Lynn, do you have a response to that, to what Dave said?
Yes. There was the other thing that deeply disturbed me was when he spoke about how the intelligence professionals couldn't bring themselves to say that the President of the United States was lying. Ray McGovern worked in the CIA during the Reagan administration. He told us in the interview about Bill Casey's practice of fudging estimates, and he's perfectly aware that Ronald Reagan's speeches about the Nicaraguans being ready to march on the United States through Brownsville, Texas,
Harlingen,
were absolutely nonsense. Yeah. I remember Brownsville.
Well, and he even said about
whatever.
That
it was complete nonsense, and that was said repeatedly by the president in public, and it was a lie. And I mean, that's only one of them. We've had a whole parade of presidents lying one after another. So how can these guys, the top analysts, supposedly these critical minds, these intellects, these seekers of truth, these without fear or favor, no holds barred, we go for the truth, we tell it straight, and they can't bring themselves to think that the president is lying? And this, like,
well, they don't listen to Pacifica. I mean,
well, no, but I mean, this cognitive dissonance between what he's telling us in the interview on one hand, and then that statement literally makes my head spin.
Well, I think it's a question of lying to whom.
Okay, wait a minute. I want to say,
I think people within the intelligence agencies are accustomed not to being lied to themselves.
Oh, so it's okay to lie to us, the public.
Well, I don't
think, as long as they don't lie to their other folks.
I think what he's saying is that this is a departure in which now, within these institutions, the lying is going on. So now there's no way of telling what's actually happening.
All right, we've got, it's lighting up. I don't know whether it's Scooter saying he's trying to get hold of Ray McGovern. We're continuing to try to call him, but we do have callers on the line. And I should say at this point that our number, and this is late night. Sort of new capital holdover. We're responding to that interview that Dave Adelson did with Ray McGovern for the L.A. Sound Posse, which we ran at the 10 o'clock hour. So now we're talking about that interview, and maybe we'll have Ray McGovern, and maybe we won't. But we do have people on the line, and let's start with Eugene. Hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, that was a great interview with that guy.
Thank Dave. He's on the line.
Yeah. Listen, on one level, I know everything I need to know about these idiots. I mean, they're a bunch of unscrupulous psychopaths. I mean, nothing is sacred to them. I mean, really. But then on another level, every time I think it can't get any worse, it does.
Well, they don't look like unscrupulous psychopaths from inside, and they have their own, you know, their own idea of integrity, and that's actually what Lynn is. That's the question Lynn is raising. What does that really consist of? If I'm not mistaken, Lynn.
I think you're giving them too much credit to posit that sort of thing going on in there. But like when I heard that Tenet was going to resign, my first reaction was, you know, surely they're not going to try and pass this whole thing off as an intelligence failure, you know.
That's what you said?
That's exactly what they're
doing. It
was
like obvious from the beginning that they were going to do that.
It was just unbelievable. The bad thing is that there is a large segment of the population in this country that's buying it.
Yep.
Well, that's where the intelligence failure is.
All the damage they're doing, and the election is still even close. Those people should be in jail. Every voter in this country should be quivering with rage, you know, and yet Bush wraps himself in the flag and hides behind the Bible. Okay, two questions that I would like to ask Mr. McGovern, for you to ask him for me if you get it. Does he think that they are going to be able to get away with it? What is his sense of it? I see a lot of the intelligence community coming out now, and you know, like he's doing, more and more of them, it seems like. And I just want to know if he thinks they're going to be able to get away with
it. Okay, I'm writing that down. I'm writing that down, Eugene.
Okay, and the other question I have, if there's time, is how long does he think it will take us to recover from the damage that they have already done?
That's a great question.
Well, honestly,
starting with Mossadegh and maybe even before?
Yes, and you know, all bets get reelected if they are, if they get elected for the first time. I mean, in that case, damage will never be undone.
Okay.
But
either go, either,
great
either
show, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye. Hey, either of you guys have a response?
Well, I guess I think I'd like to echo something I heard Ray say on KPFK last Friday, which is he questions whether, I mean, the question that I heard was how long will it take to undo the damage, and at least in terms of the corruption of the intelligence process within the CIA, what I heard McGovern Boyce saying was skepticism of whether it was recoverable, because he said that the senior managers of that institution are also accustomed now to cooking the books, that he doesn't think it can ever be. I don't think that was the actual, how long to undo it. But I guess my question would be, what would it look like to have it undone? I mean, what does it mean to undo all of this?
Well, I think less, I think of greater concern, and the question of what's undone is in terms of all of the people in the world that have been directly injured and are now sitting and devoting themselves to vengeance. And that is, and those types of things fuel cycles of violence that can span generations. You know, generations where people say, well, you know, these people came and they did this, they killed my parents,
okay,
you know, and I'm going to devote my life to, you know,
okay,
whatever.
I think we have a surprise here. What? Yeah, oh, he's on line. Who's that on two? Okay, you say Ray is on line three? Ray, is that you? Ray McGovern. No, I don't think so. See, I think he's on line two. Ray McGovern?
Hello?
Yeah, is that you?
No, it's George Tenet. You guys are dissing me bad.
George, hang on just a second.
I'm telling you, I got a drone headed your way, Odie. A drone is right over you.
A drone?
Yeah, it's going to knock out the Transformer again.
The Transformer?
You're going to be two times by the Ku Klux Klan and one time by the CIA.
Okay, so that's it. What else?
I was just saying, man, and I'm really sad. I'm crying some big crocodile tears over the sanctity of the CIA being violated, you know?
No, but you know, I mean, it's an interesting question to get from the point of view of somebody.
How sharp can a guy's analytical powers be when he believes in the Warren Commission and Martin Luther King was assassinated by James Earl Ray?
I thought he said that he had given that one up.
I don't know, man.
It
kind of reminds me, and to be brief, it kind of reminds me of when O.J. was on trial, you know, and I used to think that the networks ought to all chip in and give money for the defense of O.J. because they were making such a killing off of it. Now, all these old guys are coming out of the woodworks, guys like Richard Clark, guys like J. Cofer Black, guys that actually targeted people and
Robert McNamara
for, you know, a little small caliber bullet behind the ear, you know. And now they're getting really incensed because, W's overt lying is just too much to deal with, you know. They named the CIA building after H.W., you know, because he did such a great job there.
Mm-hmm.
And now he travels around with four black Suburbans and gets every freebie he can include. I'm sure he was probably at the All-Star game tonight, you know. I mean, these guys, you know, they live in their own little sheltered world. And as far as my opinion goes, I think special ops of all the armed forces and the CIA are the ones that are the problem, and they're Pentagon handlers, you know. And I don't ever be able to get beyond that crap, man. And you know, to me,
we have Ray on the air.
I don't
care. He's on four.
If W gets elected again and brings this whole thing down, you know.
Okay.
Thanks,
Ray. Bye bye. And
he's on the air.
And Ray, hi.
Hi, this is Ray.
That's Ray McGovern, the real Ray McGovern.
Yeah, sorry about that.
The subject of all this gossip. Welcome.
Yeah, we've been sitting here saying all kinds of things about you, but we're not going to tell you what they are.
Yeah,
but actually,
a little bit here.
Lynn Gary. Lynn Gary's on the line with us, and Dave Adelson, whom you know.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know Lynn.
No, Ray.
Okay, you guys haven't met. Lynn does a show in upstate New York called Unwelcome Guests, which is a remarkable interview show that she does every week. And, of course, we don't carry it on KPFT. But who knows? We do actually hear it from time to time. Lynn, you were going to ask Ray a question, and I think you should go.
Okay, yeah, Ray, I kind of, this is, starting from the interview that you did with Dave, because as I was saying before, I found your interview to be one of the most disturbing and fascinating things that I'd ever heard.
Really?
But maybe not for the reasons that you would expect me to say that. You described your role in the CIA as a senior analyst, a person who did daily briefings, who worked on the intelligence estimates, a person who was well-versed enough in the agency and its workings, and the knowledge, you know, and your policy area knowledge of various places to be able to advise top officials if they asked for it, based on what you knew. So my question was, in order to advise anyone on anything, you have to have a concept of what success means. You mentioned in the interview that often you brought to the attention of these officials matters that were not on their plate, that you felt, or that the agency felt, ought to be on their plate. What were your criteria for determining those things? What within the CIA is considered to be success? What is considered to be a priority? What are its goals?
Mm-hmm. Well, Lynn, those are good questions. It's certainly not the case that I made all this up in terms of what to brief. There are priorities, of course, and there are events going on in the world that sort of drive what we call current intelligence. And that's what we're involved in here 6 days a week. What's current, what's lively, what needs to be focused on today. What we would do is review the bidding at around 11 o'clock in the morning. We'd know pretty much then what had been going on, certainly in the Far East and mostly in Europe as well, since they're ahead of us on the time clock. And they would have the reporting and whatever else evidence was available. And with that, and knowing what issues were on the front burner for these folks, we would lay on a menu of items that we would want to address. And we would get the substantive experts on either the geographic area or the issue area to do the drafting. And at about 4 o'clock, we would have that draft, and it would pass muster or it would not. We'd put it into readable form, edit it, and show it around and get everybody's okay. And if all went well and it didn't need any updating overnight, that would be the item that we would be briefing to the vice president, to the other senior advisors under Reagan. Reagan didn't take that briefing himself personally. He pretty much slept in. But that's the way it would go, and then we would be there to answer questions on these items, and if there were other items that we had thought of or other things on their plate they asked us about, we would come back after the briefing and drive the process for the next day, taking into account the interests they expressed.
Ray, actually, that's actually not what I'm asking.
Okay.
What I'm asking is not about the process, but about the priorities. In other words, what are important items? When you say that you discuss what's going on, how do you discuss what's going on? Let me just give you an example.
Sure.
I'm President Reagan, and I say, well, I don't like those Sandinistas, and I want intelligence on them because, they're... I consider them to be a threat, okay? And now say that's but say I'm the president now. I'm the president, and I say, lack of oxygen is a big threat to national security, and I want you to find out who's cutting down the rainforest in the Amazon. I want you to get the operations arm to take them out because they're an enemy of national security. Okay, so now we have two presidents asking the CIA for intelligence on these threats to national security. Do you think that these two presidents, myself and Ronald Reagan, would have the same response from the people that are in their office from the CIA?
Hmm. Well, Lynn, let me ask this way. Let me answer it this way. You're talking about two separate functions that the president can use the CIA for. One is for substantive information, and the other is for operations.
But don't they interplay with one another?
No,
you want the information as to what's going on, then you come up with a solution as to how to respond, and then you move the covert arm into action to take care of the problem. I mean, there is a relationship ultimately.
So there is a conceptual relationship with respect to the substantive briefings. There's no direct relationship. What we do is give our best gloss on what's going on in Nicaragua, let's say, and if the president or the vice president or one of the senior people decide they'd like to do something about it, that is taken care of in a separate venue with the operations side of the house, which has nothing to do with the substantive briefing. In other words, we would tell him, as we did, don't worry, the Sandinistas are not going to come up through Texas like some of your crazier friends are telling you. We would tell him that. Now, it's up to the president to believe us or to not believe us or to choose a course of action that doesn't make any sense, which often happens. In other words, if you want to prevent crazy policies, the only option open to you is to elect a good president, because under the law, he can use the agency in a way that, with some permission from Congress, which may not make sense.
Okay, well, Ray, here's something that strikes me, which is that there have been a succession of presidents, you know, from different political parties. But from my perspective, it seems like irrespective of who is in the Oval Office, ultimately the U.S. foreign policy and the operations of the CIA involve activities which reinforce governments that are benefiting the profit-making activities of U.S. corporations. They repress movements within their own countries of workers who are trying to form unions, trying to stop environmental devastation, trying to make sure that they have land to grow food to feed for themselves instead of it being devoted to export crops for some corporation. And we see this on every continent. We see this decade after decade, irrespective of who is in the White House. And I guess the thing that remains somehow constant, it seems to me, is the people in the CIA who aren't in and out of office every 4 or 8 years, they're always there. And I'm wondering, to what extent might people in the CIA and some of these other, if you will, I'm just going to call it civil service, military complex, to what extent do they set a permanent agenda for what happens, how the United States conducts itself, irrespective of the overt political process? Has that something you've ever looked at?
Well, Lynn, you know, this sounds facile, but what I said before, I'll just say again. If you want good policies, if you want good foreign policy devoted to aims that are A, moral, and B, achievable, elect a good president. Now, what you've said before with respect to constancy in policy is not really the case. The policy of Jimmy Carter with respect to Nicaragua was 180 degrees away from the policy of Ronald Reagan. Under Ronald Reagan, our country did some very stupid things with respect to Nicaragua. The whole concept of the Soviet Union using Nicaragua as a cat's paw to come up through Texas and take us over, I mean, it's ridiculous on the face of it, and yet that's what the policy was. It had nothing to do with the advice we were giving to Ronald Reagan. It had to do with a whole host of other things. It was not the case under his predecessor. So, again, facile as it may seem, the agency can be used by the president under the law to do what the president wants, and it's not constant from president to president. And if you want good policies, you got to elect the president.
Okay, I want to follow up on something. This is Otis Ray. I'm here in Houston. This is a transatlantic hookup here, a transnational hookup. That I think one of the things that Lynn that I got from what Lynn was saying was how to what extent does the fact that the same people are in the CIA from administration to administration affect the actual policy, and the corollary to that is to what extent do you think the agency would color the information it gives in order to carry out that policy? I mean, there have been a bunch of movies and stuff about how the CIA is pushing the president around.
Can I modify that question? Ray, do you feel that the corruption of the intelligence process that you've described undermines...
Why would he let me ask a question?
that's just the way I am.
Okay. Dave, you could do it.
Well, I one of the things I'm curious is whether that corruption of intelligence that you're talking about means that even if you pick a good president, because you can't get the truth out of the senior managers necessarily, that you've somehow uncoupled the ability of a president to exercise effective policy oversight.
Yeah, and that certainly is an absolute corollary to what I'm saying, but it's based on the idea, I think, that Lynn was saying, that you have the same people in the CIA through multiple administrations. When would they become policymakers? Because they know what's right, given all of... Anyway, I'm sorry, Ray, go ahead.
Yeah, well, no, I guess I really should have begun at the beginning. The movies and the TV do not give an accurate picture of what the CIA is or how it works.
I'm sure.
Let me just be very brief here. But in 1947, when the CIA was set up under the legislation which created also the Defense Department, the idea was to have one place in government which could analyze things substantively, come up and tell the president that he had no clothes on if necessary, tell the president what's going on in the world without fear or favor, and to be that one place where all the information came together. In other words, a central intelligence agency. Okay. Now, in that legislation, there was also language that said the president can use the central intelligence agency for other purposes which from time to time may be necessary. Okay, now that's the clause that under the law the president can use the CIA for covert action and the kinds of stuff that you've been focusing on.
That's not where I'm focusing.
Well, what Lynn was talking about, I think. Yeah.
And that's the thing that just drives people nuts, the fact that we have these things going on from Mossadegh on.
Yeah, but see, the idea that the agency is an independent actor is spurious. It's not. It does what the president tells it to do.
No, but I think it's a legitimate question to say you do have this institutionalization that goes on. I mean, the CIA was started with a certain personality. I mean, Wild Bill Donovan was extremely involved in that, and that's a very activist personality. But what I'm saying is, and what I think Lynn was saying is the fact that you have the same people in the CIA over a period of time. Does that begin to affect policy by virtue of the information that they give any given president? And this is not to excuse, you know, behavior by Reagan and so forth.
Well,
but I'm just wondering you were there. Do you see that?
It's a legitimate question, and one might assume that would be the case. But generally speaking, it was not the case.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the operations people would do what they were told in terms of one president to the next.
Yeah.
The substantive people, at their best, and that's what's been sort of corrupted now, the substantive people would look at the merits of a given situation and call it like it was. The substantive people didn't have any access to grind. I know I was one of them. Times, there were presidents or even directors of the CIA that did have access to grind and try to skew the information, just as has happened with this president and Iraq, but those in my day were the exceptions, and now unfortunately
maybe they're the rule.
A slightly different question, and right, it's this: there must have been times during the course of your career, possibly many times, where you provided a certain information or analysis to the president, saw it misused, and not only saw it misused, but saw dire consequences as a result. Wars, death, unnecessary death, exploitation, whatever you want to call it. There must have been other times when even the right decision, so to speak, led to that. What was it like to be within that system, operating as best you could according to what, you know, your own ethics dictated about providing that information, and yet seeing these outcomes? What was
without fear or favor?
How did you deal with that conflict?
Mm-hmm. Well, it'd be hard. I'd be hard pressed to recall a situation where the analysis would have been so directly involved in forming policies that had those kinds of effects. I'm searching my mind now to... Mostly it was a case of pointing out imminent dangers that were about to happen. The Turks taking over Cyprus or something like that, rather than something that required a response that... of the kind you're talking about.
Well, how about the arming of the Mujahideen as part of the response to the Soviet occupation Afghanistan?
Now, that's a very good question, Yo. Now, how is that decided? Well, what typically happens in cases like that is the substantive people try to project what it would mean to arm these folks. And in this case, the blinders of the Cold War were still on. The highest priority was put on defeating the Soviet Union in a place where it was exposed and vulnerable. And so that was what the presidents were seized with. And Brzezinski, of course, was still there working for Carter. They thought, well, hey, we can bleed the Soviets white here, and let's do it. And so the operations people under the NSC, under Brzezinski, arm these people. Now, whether or not the substantive people were smart enough then to say, now, wait a second, you know, this could come back and bite us real hard. Well, I do know when one of the major issues was, should we give them Stinger missiles? Stinger missiles are those, surface-to-air missiles that could be shoulder-fired. Should we give them that? Well, that was a big decision because those could certainly come back to haunt us. The decision was made not by the CIA, but by the president and his chief advisors. Yeah, give it to them.
And the CIA was right about that one. I wanted to say, because I know that we've all got stuff. I've got a couple people on the air. Somebody's been hanging on for 25 minutes now.
Okay.
And 25 minutes. Yeah, okay. And so I'd like to put them on and give them a chance. And line six, I don't know your name, but did you just... Everybody speak up. Everybody who called in, say hi. Okay, I don't think there's anybody on line six because.
Okay, well, in that gap of time, let me ask Ray also, following up. The long-term implication of that policy of arming the Mujahideen, was that something that the analysis side was tasked with looking at?
Ideally, that should have been the case. Unfortunately, I was overseas at the time.
Were you there for Saddam?
Tour, so I wasn't really in the flow of things there, so I don't know exactly analysts...
Were you there for the Iraq-Iran war?
I was, yeah. I was back...
Because the same issue came up with Saddam, and, you know, he's not the only one.
Yeah.
About arming Saddam and supporting Saddam.
Yeah.
So how was the long-term, you know, analysis balanced with the short-term, what do we do to achieve this proximate goal? How were those balanced? Because that long-term modeling and analysis and predictive capacity does require some sense of goals that have to transcend individual administration.
Mm-hmm.
And is it the structure, is it our political structure that actually puts that kind of thing off the table, or does it go on?
Well, you've heard and read a lot about national intelligence estimates recently. Most recently with that fiasco that we veteran intelligence professionals for sanity call the Whore of Babylon. I refer specifically to the National Intelligence Estimate of October 1,
2002, which talked about all these weapons of mass destruction that Saddam Hussein did not have.
Right, and you referred to that in your interview.
Yeah. Okay, now, the National Intelligence Estimate is not just an agency product. This is a product of the whole community. And the State Department, for example, to its great credit, got a lot of things right in that estimate, but they were relegated to footnotes. In any case, an estimate is supposed to be done to project forward what will happen if this or that course of action is chosen. In this case, one of the corrupting factors was that the director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, avoided doing such an estimate. Why? Well, because it would have come out perhaps not the way the president wanted. And so he avoided doing that until it was absolutely necessary. When it became necessary, that was when they had to fool Congress into supporting that war. In a word, the estimate's supposed to look forward. It's supposed to be done without fear or favor, and it's served up to the president and his chief advisors. What happens then is beyond the ability or the province of the CIA to control. These are decisions made by the National Security Advisor, the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, the President himself, and those are out of the hands.
Possibly his wife.
And possibly his wife.
I got another person on the line, and we've only got about 8 more minutes, so I want to give them a chance to call. They've been holding 17 minutes. Tom, hi. You're on the air with Dave Adelson, Lynn Gary, and Ray McGovern.
Thank you. Mr. McGovern, sir.
Yeah.
When were you with the CIA? What years?
1963 to 1990.
And I was in the Marine Corps way back when.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have to take an oath of office, or was it just a civil service job?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that. What did you say about
a
civil service job?
You have to take an oath when you joined the CIA,
mm-hmm.
or was it just a civil service job?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the
Did you have to take an oath of office?
Yes, like every other civil service.
Yeah.
We took some set of oaths.
Everybody does.
Okay, well, I guess I'm with Lynn, who I probably don't share a lot of political views with, but I'm a little bit disturbed about this ex post facto morality. I heard you talk about people who had mortgages and kids in school, but is what you're saying that you and other people in the CIA put their careers above their country?
You ask a very good question, and it depends on. Yeah, that's.
It's not one I want to answer.
Tough decision. Let's take these folks that know about the prostitution of intelligence with respect to Iraq.
Well, what did you do about Vietnam?
Wait a minute.
What did I do about Vietnam?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Joint Chiefs of Staff should have all resigned.
Yeah, I do too. I think the guys in power now should all resign. When Shinseki got that kind of treatment from Wolfowitz, they should, as a team, have resigned.
You're changing the subject on me.
Tom, I hate to say it, but it sounds like you kind of want an abject confession from Roy.
Well, no, what I want is why he decided, while he was at the CIA, he didn't act on the moral views that he's now proclaiming.
Okay.
Well, all right.
I think that's a legitimate question.
Yeah.
My job was to look at what the Soviets were doing with respect to Vietnam. That was my analytical task. When I saw that our policy was based on the hope, I underscore hope, that the Soviets would pull our chestnuts out of the fire on Vietnam and use, quote, their influence in Hanoi to help us out in the end run, I saw that was fallacious on its face because the Soviets didn't have any influence in Hanoi. I did all I could to make sure that was made clear to the president and everyone else down the line. When that became not possible to get that word out, I published it in an open journal, much like our friend Anonymous has done with respect to his book.
Yeah.
It talks about imperial hubris. So one does what one can. One is not all powerful, and one is not all knowing. And I, frankly, was slow to see how foolish our policy was in Vietnam. But when I did see it,
I did what I could to write it up and make it available publicly.
Right, Roy, Tom, I'm going to go on to Andre because we only have very little time left.
Okay, Doc. I just want to make the point about being with an institution. We live in an institutional culture where institutions exert power, and if you are within them, you are always faced with what do I do when the institutional thrust differs from my own.
Where can I do the most good, by quitting or by staying? Yes, that's a question I have to ask from time to time.
That's
okay, who's on line six? I don't have your name. You're in a car.
Andre, I got cut off.
Earlier. Oh, I'm sorry, Andre.
Okay.
Oh, that was my mistake. I apologize.
That's fine.
Well, somebody cut you off again? I can't believe it. The way this phone system works, anybody can cut anybody off, and you got to be really careful. Okay. Well, we have Dave, Lynn, and I bet there Andre's calling back. No, he will call back. It wasn't intentional, Andre. I hope you're listening. We've only got about five more minutes. Lynn hasn't said anything for a little while.
Yeah, I've been trying to give other people a chance.
This may be Andre.
Yeah, I guess. Is that
let me
Andre?
Let me try him. Let me see if I can get him on. Amina's talking to him.
I'll yield to Andre.
Yeah, it's Andre. So we've got him back. Okay, Andre, I've got you locked on now. Go ahead. Thanks for calling back.
I'm sorry. I'll try to make this quick.
Yeah, you go ahead. You got to be really quick because we only got about 3 minutes.
I just got a quick question. I know your guest. I forgot his name. I'm sorry. I'm driving. I'm talking.
Roy McGovern.
He was with the CIA. I wanted to know if he knew any information about Reagan was doing while he was in office, using the CIA to fuel the war, the Iran-Contra war, selling drugs or using that drug money to pay for the war, or if he has any information on it, and I'll hang up and I'll listen off there.
Thanks, Andre. Great Thank question.
Andre?
Yeah, he's going to listen on the air.
Oh, all right.
He hears you.
Yeah, okay. No, I didn't know anything about drug money, and I don't think there was any drug money involved in the Iran-Contra business.
Really?
Yeah, the Iran-Contra thing was completely independent of all these reports about drug money.
The Gary Webb articles and Pete Bruton?
As far as I know, yeah.
Okay. Lynn?
I guess back to the...
we got about two more minutes because we've got
to
be wrapping it up.
The primary question of... beyond people having an axe to grind, say, within the agency, there are people that think in a certain framework. I mean, in other words, how does one, you know, how one defines a problem? You know, when you talk about outcomes, to even suggest, for example, you talked about arming the Mujahideen, to suggest that, well, okay, a priority is to attack the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union is a problem. Okay, that is a political framework. That is a political framework in which the analysis is taking place. So every piece of analysis is, say, colored by that basic assumption.
Okay, Lynn, you got to let it go because and Ray, comment.
Yeah, that's really not an accurate portrayal. What you're mixing up policy and intelligence here. The policy was this anti-communism, and that was the prevailing mindset, and that's why we did things like we did in arming the Mujahideen.
Who made that mindset prevail?
I have to tell you again, the president does this. The president is chief advisors. It's not the CIA. It's the president. So the good president.
You're saying ultimately you report accurate stuff, and the president does whatever he wants with it.
Ideally,
basically,
that's
what you're saying. Ideally, right.
But lately, it hasn't worked that way, and that's what disturbs me greatly.
Okay.
I just want to comment.
We got to wrap it up. Everybody's got to get 20 seconds.
I want to comment how extraordinary it is that Ray was willing to come on.
Oh, yes.
And essentially have this kind of critique, and very personal critique. And, Ray, I really want to thank you both for the time you took for the original interview and to be here, because I think it takes a lot of guts, and I don't think a lot of people are willing to expose themselves to what goes on in Pacifica when it's at its best, which is probing the uncomfortable places. Thanks very much.
And thanks, Dave.
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks, Dave, for the interview. Thank Lynn for all you do, and I want to thank you, Ray, too.
Thank you, Ray.
For really giving this opportunity. It's something you didn't have to do.
Well,
and I think this.
I have the impression we talked past each other, and I guess we need a good bit more time than we had tonight to.
I'd love to do it.
Really understand one.
You want to do it next week? We'll do it next week.
I'm open to that.
Let's talk about it. Okay. I think it might be fun because I think that there are probably a lot of misconceptions everywhere. Okay, and this is Odie and Scooter for.